truly outstanding. I don't know what to say. This is exactly the painting I was hoping for. I could tell from his eyes that he was saying how he honestly felt. He was truly impressed and moved by my painting. The painting expresses me perfectly, Manshiki said. This is a portrait in the real sense of the word. You didn't make any mistake. You did exactly what you should have. His hand was still resting on my shoulder. It was just resting there, yet I could feel a special power radiating from it. But what did you do to discover this painting? Manshiki asked me. Discover? It was you who did this painting, of course. You created it through your own power. But you also discovered it. You found this image buried within you and drew it out. You unearthed it, in a way. Don't you think so? I suppose so, I thought. Of course, I moved my hands and followed my will in painting it. I was the one who chose the paints, the one who used brushes, knives, and fingers to paint the colors onto the canvas. But looked at from a different angle, maybe all I'd done was use Manshiki as a catalyst to locate something buried inside me and dig it up. Just like the heavy equipment that moved aside the rock mound behind the little shrine, lifted off the heavy lattice cover, and unearthed that odd stone-lined chamber. I couldn't help but see an affinity between these two similar operations that took place in tandem. Everything that had happened had started with Manshiki's appearance and the ringing of the bell in the middle of the night. Manshiki said, "It's like an earthquake deep under the sea. In an unseen world, a place where light doesn't reach, in the realm of the unconscious. In other words, a major transformation is taking place. It reaches the surface, where it sets off a series of reactions and eventually takes form where we can see it with our own eyes. I'm no artist, but I can grasp the basic idea behind that process. Outstanding ideas in the business world, too, emerge through a similar series of stages. The best ideas are thoughts that appear, unbidden, from out of the dark." Manshiki once more stood before the painting and stepped closer to examine the surface. Like someone reading a detailed map, he studiously checked out each and every detail. He stepped back 9 feet and, with narrowed eyes, gazed at the work as a whole. His face wore an expression close to ecstasy. He reminded me of a carnivorous raptor about to latch on to its prey. But what was the prey? Was it my painting, or me myself, or something else? I had no idea, but soon, like mist hovering over the surface of a river at dawn, that strange expression, like ecstasy, faded, then vanished, to be filled in by his usual affable, thoughtful expression. He said, "Generally, I avoid saying anything that smacks of self-praise, but honestly I feel kind of proud to know that I didn't misjudge things. I have no artistic talent myself and have nothing to do with creating original works, but I do know outstanding art when I see it. At least I flatter myself that I do." Somehow, I couldn't easily accept what Manshiki was telling me, or feel happy to hear it. It may have been those sharp, raptor-like eyes that bothered me. "So, you like the painting?" I asked again to make sure. "That goes without saying. This is truly a valuable painting. I'm overjoyed that you came up with such a powerful work using me as the model, as the motif, And of course it goes without saying that as the one who commissioned the painting, I'll take it. Assuming that's all right with you. Yes, it's just that I... Manshiki held up a hand to cut me off. So, if you don't mind, I'd like to invite you to my house to celebrate its completion. Would that be all right? It will be, like the old expression, a cozy little get-together. As long as this isn't any trouble for you, that is. None at all. But you really don't need to do this. You've done so much already. But I'd really like to. I'd like the two of us to celebrate the completion of the painting. So won't you join me for dinner at my place? Nothing fancy, just a simple little dinner, just the two of us. Apart from the cook and bartender, of course. Cook and bartender? There's a French restaurant I like, near Hayakawa Harbor. I'll have the cook and bartender over on their regular day off. He's a great chef. He uses the freshest fish and comes up with some very original recipes. Actually, for quite some time I've been wanting to invite you over and have been making preparations. But with the painting done, the timing couldn't be better. It was hard to keep the surprise from showing on my face. I had no idea how much it would cost to arrange something like that, but for Manshiki, it must be a regular occurrence, or at least something he was accustomed to arranging. Manshiki said, "How would 4 days from now be?" "Tuesday evening. If that's good for you, I'll set it up." "I don't have any particular plans then," I said. "Tuesday it is then," he said. "Also, could I take the painting home with me now? I'd like to have it nicely framed and hanging on the wall by the time you come over, if that's possible." "Mr. Manshiki, do you really see your face within this painting?" I asked again. "Of course I do," Manshiki said, giving me a wondering look. "Of course I can see my face in the painting. Very distinctly. What else is depicted here?" "I see," I said. What else could I say? "You're the one who commissioned the work, so if you like the painting, it's already yours. Please do what you'd like with it. The thing is, the paint isn't dry yet, so be extremely careful when you carry it. And I think it's better to wait a little longer before framing it. Best to let it dry for about 2 weeks before doing that." "I understand. I'll handle it carefully. And I'll wait to have it framed." At the front door, he held out his hand, and we shook hands for the first time in a while. A satisfied smile rose to his face. "I'll see you Tuesday, then. I'll send a car over around 6. "By the way, you aren't inviting the mummy?" I asked Manshiki. I don't know why I said that. The mummy just suddenly popped into my head, and I couldn't help myself. Manshiki looked at me searchingly. "Mummy? What do you mean?" "The mummy that should have been in that chamber. The one that must have been ringing the bell every night and disappeared, leaving the bell behind. The monk who practiced austerity to the point of being mummified. I was thinking maybe he wanted to be invited to your place, like the statue of the Commendatore in Don Giovanni." Manshiki thought about this, and a cheerful smile came over him as if he finally got it. "I see. Just like Don Giovanni invited the statue of the Commendatore, you're wondering how would it be if I invited the mummy to our dinner?" "Exactly. It might be karma, too." "Sounds good. Fine with me. It's a celebration, after all. If the mummy would care to join us, I will be happy to issue the invitation. Sounds like we'll have a pleasant evening. But what should we have for dessert?" He smiled happily. "The problem is, we can't see him. Makes it hard to invite him." "Indeed," I said. "But the visible is not the only reality. Wouldn't you agree?" Manshiki gingerly carried the painting outside. He took an old blanket from the trunk, laid it on the passenger seat, and placed the painting down on top so as not to smear the paint. Then he used some thin rope and two cardboard boxes to secure the painting so it wouldn't move around. It was all cleverly done. He always seemed to carry around a variety of tools and things in his trunk. "Yes, what you said may be exactly right," Manshiki suddenly murmured as he was leaving. He rested both hands on the leather-covered steering wheel and looked straight up at me. "What I said? That sometimes in life we can't grasp the boundary between reality and unreality. That boundary always seems to be shifting, as if the border between countries shifts from one day to the next, depending on their mood. We need to pay close attention to that movement. Otherwise, we won't know which side we're on. That's what I meant when I said it might be dangerous for me to remain inside that pit any longer." I didn't know how to respond, and Manshiki didn't go any further. He waved to me out the window, revving the V8 engine so it rumbled pleasantly, and he in the still-not-dry portrait vanished from sight.
Chapter 19. Can you see anything behind me? At 1 p.m. on Saturday afternoon, my girlfriend drove over in her red Mini. I went out to greet her when she arrived. She had on green sunglasses and a light gray jacket over a simple beige dress. "You want to do it in the car, or do you prefer the bed?" I asked.
"Don't be silly," she laughed.
"Doing it in the car doesn't sound so bad. Figuring out how to manage it in a cramped space.
Someday soon."
We sat in the living room and drank tea. I told her about how I'd just managed to finish the portrait, or portrait-like painting, of Manshiki I'd been struggling with, and how it was totally different from any of the portraits I'd done professionally. Her interest seemed piqued.
"Can I see the painting?"
I shook my head. "You're a day late. I wanted to get your opinion on it, but Mr. Manshiki already took it home. The paint wasn't completely dry yet, but it seemed like he wanted to take possession as soon as he could. He seemed worried somebody else might take it away."
"So he liked it?"
"He said he did, and I don't have any reason to doubt him."
"The painting successfully completed, and the person who commissioned it likes it. So all's well that ends well?"
"I guess," I said. "And I'm happy with it. I've never done that type of painting before, and I think it's opened up some new possibilities."
"A new style of portrait?"
"I'm not sure. This time I arrived at that method by using Mr. Manshiki as my model. But maybe it's just coincidence that it was the framework of a portrait that proved to be the entranceway to that. I don't know if the same method would be valid if I tried it again. This might have been a special case. Having Mr. Manshiki as my model may have exerted a special power. But the important thing is I'm dying to do some serious painting now."
"Well, congratulations on finishing the painting."
"Thanks," I said. "I'll also be receiving a fairly hefty payment."
"The munificent Mr. Manshiki," she said.
"And he invited me over to his place to celebrate the painting. Tuesday evening. We'll have dinner together." I told her about the dinner that was planned. Nothing about inviting the mummy, though. A dinner for two with a professional cook and bartender.
"So you'll finally set foot in that chalk-white mansion, won't you?" she said, sounding impressed. "The mysterious mansion of the man of mystery. I'm so curious.
Make sure to keep your eyes open and observe what kind of place it is. As much as my eyes can take in. And remember exactly what sort of food was served."
"Will do," I said.
"You know, the other day you mentioned getting new information about Mr. Manshiki."
"That's right, through the jungle grapevine."
"What kind of information?"
She looked a little confused. She picked up her cup and took a sip of tea. "Let's talk about that later," she said. "There's something I'd like to do before that."
"Something you'd like to do?"
"Something I hesitate to put into words."
We moved from the living room into the bedroom, like always.
During the 6 years I lived my first married life with Yuzu, my former marriage is what it might best be called, I never had a sexual relationship with any other women, not even once. Not that the opportunity didn't present itself, but during that period, I was much more interested in living a peaceful life with my wife than seeking greener pastures elsewhere. And as far as sex was concerned, regular lovemaking with Yuzu more than satisfied me. But then, at a certain point, out of the blue, to me at least, she announced that she couldn't live with me any longer. An unshakable conclusion, no room for negotiation or compromise. I was shaken, with no clue how to respond, left speechless. But I did understand one thing. I can't stay here anymore. So I threw some belongings into my old Peugeot 205 and set off on an aimless journey. For a month and a half at the beginning of spring, I wandered through northern Japan, Tohoku and Hokkaido, where it was still cold, until my car finally broke down for good. Every night on the trip, I remembered Yuzu's body, every single detail, how she'd react when I touched certain spots, what sort of cry she made. I didn't want to remember this, but I couldn't help it. Occasionally, as I traced those memories, I'd ejaculate, another thing I didn't particularly want to do. But during that long trip, I only slept with one actual woman. A truly weird turn of events ended with me spending the night with a young woman I'd never seen before. Not that it was something I was looking for. This was in a small town in Miyagi Prefecture, along the coast. As I recall, it was near the border with Iwate, but I was on the move then, and had passed through a number of towns that all blurred into one. My mind wasn't in a place where I could remember their names. I do recall that it had a big fishing harbor, though most of the towns in that region had harbors. And I remember how everywhere I went the smell of diesel oil and fish tagged along. On the outskirts of town, near the highway, was a chain restaurant, and I was eating dinner there by myself. It was about 8 p.m., shrimp curry and house salad. There were only a handful of other customers. I was in a table next to the window, reading a paperback book while I ate, when a young woman abruptly sat down across from me. No hesitation, no asking permission. Without a word, she sat down onto the vinyl-covered seat like it was the most natural thing in the world. I looked up, surprised. Of course, I didn't recognize her. It was the first time I'd ever laid eyes on her. It was all so sudden, I didn't know what to think. There were any number of unoccupied tables and no reason for her to share mine. Maybe that's how they did things in this town? I put down my fork, wiped my mouth with the paper napkin, and gazed at her, bewildered.
"Pretend like you know me," the girl said. "Like we were meeting up here."
Her voice was, if anything, a bit husky, or maybe tension made a voice temporarily hoarse. I detected a slight Tohoku accent. I put the bookmark in my book and shut it. The woman seemed to be in her mid-twenties. She had on a white blouse with a round collar and a navy blue cardigan, neither one very expensive-looking or very fashionable. Ordinary clothes like what you'd wear when you went shopping at the local supermarket. Her hair was black, cut short, with bangs falling to her forehead. She had on hardly any makeup. On her lap was a black cloth shoulder bag. There was nothing special about her face. Pleasant enough features, but they didn't leave a strong impression. The kind of face that, if you saw her on the street, you'd forget as soon as you passed by. Her thin lips were taut, and she was breathing through her nose. Her breathing was a bit ragged, the nostrils expanding a tiny bit, then contracting. A small nose, out of balance with the size of her mouth. As if the person molding her out of clay halfway through decided to scrape some off the nose.
"You understand? Pretend like you know me," she repeated. "Don't look so surprised."
"Okay," I answered, not knowing what was going on.
"Just keep on eating," she said, "and pretend to be talking to me like we know each other."
"What about?"
"You're from Tokyo?"
I nodded. I picked up my fork and ate a mini tomato, then drank some water.
"I could tell by the way you talk," the woman said. "But why are you here?"
"Just passing through," I said. A waitress in a ginger-colored uniform came over, lugging a thick menu. The waitress had mammoth breasts, the buttons on her uniform ready to burst. The girl across from me didn't take the menu. She didn't even glance at the waitress. Staring straight at me, she just said, "Coffee and cheesecake," like she was giving me the order. The waitress nodded without a word. Still lugging the menu, she left.
"Are you in some kind of trouble?" I asked.
She didn't respond. She just stared at me, like she was evaluating my face.
"Can you see anything behind me? Is anybody there?" the woman asked.
I looked behind her. Just ordinary people eating in an ordinary way. No new customers had come in.
"Nothing. Nobody's there," I said.
"Keep an eye out for a little longer," she said. "Tell me if you see anything. Keep on talking like nothing's happened."
Our table looked out on the parking lot. I could see my decrepit, dusty little old Peugeot parked there. There were two other cars, a small silver compact and a tall black minivan. The minivan looked new. They'd both been parked there for a while. No new cars had driven in. The woman must have walked, or else someone gave her a ride here.
"Just passing through?" the woman asked.
"That's right."
"Are you on a trip?"
"You could say that," I said.
"What kind of book are you reading?"
I showed her the book. It was Ogai Mori's Abe Ichizoku, a samurai tale written over 100 years before.
"Abe Ichizoku," she intoned.
She handed the book back.
"How come you're reading such an old book?"
"It was in the lounge of a youth hostel I stayed at in Aomori not long ago. I leafed through it, thought it was interesting, and took it with me. In exchange, I left a couple of books I'd finished reading."
"I've never read Abe Ichizoku. Is it interesting?"
I'd read it once and was rereading it. The story was pretty interesting, but I couldn't figure out why and from what sort of stance Ogai had written it or felt compelled to write that kind of tale. But explaining that would take too long. This wasn't a book club, and this woman was just bringing up random topics so our conversation seemed natural, or at least so that it looked that way to the people around us.
"It's worth reading," I said.
"So what sort of work?" she asked.
"You mean the novel?"
She frowned.
"No, I don't care about that. I mean you. What kind of work do you do for a living?"
"I paint pictures," I said.
"You're an artist," she said.
"You could say that."
"What sort of paintings?"
"Portraits," I said.
"By portraits, you mean those paintings you see hanging on the wall in the president's office in companies? The ones where big shots look all full of themselves?"
"That's right."
"That's your specialty?"
I nodded. She said no more about painting. She might have lost interest. Most people in the world, unless they're the ones being painted, have zero interest in portraits. Right then, the automatic door at the entrance slid open, and a tall, middle-aged man came in. He had on a black leather jacket and a black golf cap with a golf company's logo on it. He stood at the entrance, gave the whole diner a once-over, chose a table two over from ours, and sat down facing us. He took off his cap, finger-combed his hair a couple of times, and carefully studied the menu the busty waitress brought over. His hair was cut short and had some white mixed in. He was thin, with dark, suntanned skin. His forehead was lined with a series of deep, wavy wrinkles. "A man just came in," I told her.
"What does he look like?"
I gave her a quick description.
"Can you draw him?" she asked.
"You mean a likeness?"
"Yes, you're an artist, aren't you?"
I took a memo pad from my pocket and, using a mechanical pencil, quickly sketched the man, even added some shading. While I drew it, I didn't need to glance over at him. I have the ability to grasp the features of a person quickly and etch them into my memory. I passed the drawing across the table to her. She took it and stared at it, eyes narrowed for a long time, like a bank teller examining dubious handwriting on a check. Finally, she laid the memo page on the table.
"You're really good at drawing," she said, looking at me.
She sounded genuinely impressed. "It's what I do," I said. "So, do you know this man?" She didn't reply, just shook her head. Her lips tight, her expression unchanged. She folded the drawing up twice and stuffed it away in her shoulder bag. I couldn't figure out why she would keep something like that. She should have just crumpled it up and thrown it away.
"I don't know him," she said.
"But you're being followed by him. Is that what's going on?" She didn't reply. The same waitress brought over her coffee and cheesecake. The woman kept quiet until the waitress had left. She sliced a bite of the cheesecake with her fork, then pushed it from side to side on the plate, like a hockey player practicing on the ice before a game. She finally put the piece in her mouth and, expressionless, chewed slowly. Once she finished it, she poured a hint of cream into her coffee and took a sip. She nudged the plate with the cheesecake to one side, as if it was no longer needed. A white SUV had joined the cars in the parking lot. A stocky, tall car with solid-looking tires, apparently driven by the man who'd just come in. He'd parked the car facing in, not backing into the spot, as was more usual. On the cover of the spare tire attached to the luggage compartment were the words Subaru Forester. I finished my shrimp curry. The waitress came over to take away the plate, and I ordered coffee.
"Have you been traveling for a long time?"
the woman asked.
"It'll be a long trip," I said. "Is it fun to travel?"
"I'm not traveling for fun," is how I should have answered, but that would have made things long and complicated.
"Sort of," I answered.
She stared at me like studying some rare animal.
"You sure are a man of few words."
"It depends on who I'm talking with," is how I should have answered. But going there would have also made things long and complicated. The coffee came, and I drank some. It tasted like coffee, but it wasn't all that good. But at least it was coffee, and piping hot. After this, no other customers came in. The salt-and-pepper-haired man in the leather jacket, in a voice that carried, ordered a Salisbury steak and rice. A string section version of Fool on the Hill came over the sound system. Did John Lennon write that song or Paul McCartney? I couldn't remember. Probably Lennon. This kind of random thought rattled around in my head. I had no idea what else I should think about.
"Did you come here by car?" "What kind of car?"
"A red Peugeot."
"What district is the license plate?"
"Shinagawa," I said. Hearing that, she frowned, as if she had a bad memory associated with a red Peugeot with Shinagawa plates. She tugged down the sleeves of her cardigan and checked that the buttons on her white shirt were done all the way up. She wiped her mouth with a paper napkin.
"Let's go,"
she suddenly said. She drank a half glass of water and stood up. She left her coffee, only one sip taken, and cheesecake, only one bite taken, on the tabletop, like the remains after a terrible natural disaster. Not knowing where we were going, I stood up after her, took the bill from the table, and paid at the register. The woman's order was included, but she didn't say a word of thanks or make a move to pay her share. As we left, the man with the salt and pepper hair was eating his Salisbury steak, seemingly bored by it all. He looked up and glanced in our direction, but that was all. He looked down at his plate again and went on eating, with knife and fork, his face expressionless. The woman didn't look at him at all. As we passed by the white Subaru Forester, a bumper sticker on it with a picture of a fish caught my eye. Probably a marlin. Of course, I had no idea why he had to have a sticker with a marlin on it on his car. Maybe he worked in the fishing industry, or was a fisherman. The woman didn't tell me where we were going. She sat in the passenger seat and gave me clipped directions. She seemed to know the roads. She must have been from that town, or else had lived there a long time. I drove the Peugeot where she told me to go. We drove along the highway for a while out of town and came to a love hotel with a gaudy neon sign. I parked there as directed and cut the engine. "I'm staying here tonight," she announced. "I can't go home. Come with me." "But I'm staying in another place tonight," I said. "I've already checked in and put my luggage in the room."
"Where?"
I gave the name of a small business hotel near the railway station.
"This place is a lot better than that cheap place," she said. "Your room there must be shabby and no bigger than a closet."
Right she was. A shabby room the size of a closet was an apt description.
"And they don't like women checking in by themselves here. They're on guard against prostitutes. So come with me."
Well, at least she's not a hooker, I thought. At the front desk, I paid in advance for one night, again, no word of thanks from her, and got the key. Once in the room, she filled up the bathtub, switched on the TV, and adjusted the lighting. The bathtub was spacious. It was definitely a lot more comfortable than the business hotel. She seemed to have come here, or someplace like it, many times before. She sat on the bed and took off her cardigan, then removed her white blouse and her wraparound skirt, and took off her stockings. She had on very simple white panties. They weren't particularly new, the kind your ordinary housewife would wear when she went shopping at the neighborhood supermarket. She neatly reached behind her and unhooked her bra, folded it, and set it next to a pillow. Her breasts weren't particularly big or particularly small.
"Come over here," she said to me. "Since we're in a place like this, let's have sex."
That was the one and only sexual experience of my whole long trip, or wanderings. Wilder sex than I'd expected. She had 4 orgasms in total, every single one genuine, if you can believe it. I came twice, but oddly enough, didn't feel much pleasure. It was like while I was doing it with her, my mind was elsewhere.
"I'm thinking maybe it's been a long time since you had sex," she asked me.
"Several months," I answered honestly.
"I can tell," she said. "But how come? You can't be that unpopular with women."
"There's a whole bunch of reasons."
"You poor thing," she said,
and gently stroked my neck.
"You poor thing."
"You poor thing," I thought, repeating the words to myself. Put that way, I really did feel like I was a person to be pitied. In an unknown town, in some random place, with no clue what was going on, naked in bed with a woman whose name I didn't even know. We had a few beers from the fridge in between rounds. It was about 1 a.m. when we finally slept. When I woke up the next morning, she was nowhere to be seen. She left no note or anything behind. I was alone in the overly huge bed. My watch showed 7:30, and it was light outside. I opened the curtain and saw the highway running alongside the ocean. Huge refrigerated trucks transporting fresh fish roared up and down the road. The world is full of lonely things, but not many could be lonelier than waking up alone in the morning in a love hotel. A thought suddenly struck me, and I hurriedly checked my wallet in my pants pocket. Everything was still there. Cash, credit cards, ATM card, license, everything. I breathed a sigh of relief. If my wallet had been gone, I would have freaked. These sorts of things did happen, and I needed to be careful. She must have left early in the morning while I was sound asleep. But how had she gotten back to town, or back to where she lived? Had she walked? Or called a taxi? Not that it made any difference to me. Pointless speculation. I returned the room key at the front desk, paid for the beers we'd drunk, and drove the Peugeot back to town. I needed to get the luggage I'd left at the business hotel near the station and pay for the one night. Along the way into town, I passed by the chain restaurant I'd gone to the night before. I stopped and ate breakfast there. I was starving and was dying for some coffee. Just before I pulled into the parking lot, I saw the white Subaru Forester, parked nose in with that Marlin bumper sticker, the same Subaru Forester from the night before. The only difference was where it was parked, which made sense. No one spent the whole night in a place like that. I went inside the restaurant. As before, hardly any customers. Like I expected, the same man from last night was at a table, eating breakfast. The same table as the night before, wearing the same black leather jacket. Like last night, the same black golf cap with the Yonexa logo resting on the tabletop. The only difference from last night was the folded morning newspaper on top of the table. A plate of toast and scrambled eggs was in front of him. It was probably just served, steam still rising from the coffee. As I passed him, the man glanced up and looked me in the face. His eyes were even sharper and colder than the night before. There was a sense of criticism in them, or at least that's what it felt like. "I know exactly where you've been and what you've been up to," he seemed to be telling me. That's the whole story of what happened to me in that small town along the seacoast in Miyagi. Even now, I have no idea what that woman, with her petite nose and perfect teeth, wanted from me. And it was never clear to me if that middle-aged guy with the white Subaru Forester was really following her, or if she was running from him. Whatever was going on, I happened to be there, and through an odd series of events spent the night in a garish love hotel with a woman I'd just met and had a one-night stand, the wildest sex I'd ever had. But I still can't recall the name of the town. "Could I get a glass of water?" my married girlfriend said. She'd just woken up from a short post-coital nap. It was early afternoon, and we were in bed. While she slept, I stared at the ceiling and recalled the events in that small fishing town. It was only a half a year before, but it seemed like events from the distant past. I went to the kitchen, poured mineral water into a large glass, and returned to bed. She drank down half of it in a single gulp. "Now, about Mr. Manshiki," she said, placing the glass on the nightstand.
"Mr. Manshiki?"
"The new information I got about Mr. Manshiki," she said. "What I said I'd tell you later?"
"Your jungle grapevine."
"Right," she said, and drank more water. "According to my sources, your friend Mr. Manshiki spent quite a long time in Tokyo prison."
I sat up and looked at her.
"Tokyo prison?" "Yeah, the one in Kosuge."
"For what crime?"
"I don't know the details, but I imagine it had something to do with money. Tax evasion, money laundering, insider trading, something of that sort, or perhaps all of them. He was imprisoned 6 or 7 years ago. Did Mr. Manshiki tell you what kind of work he does?
He said it was dealing with tech and information, I said. He started a company and some years ago sold the stock for a high price. He's living now on the capital gains.
Dealing with information is a pretty vague way of describing it. Nowadays, there are hardly any jobs not connected with information.
Who told you about him being in prison?
A friend of mine whose husband's in finance. But I don't know how much of that information is true. Someone heard it from someone and passed it along to someone else. You know how it is. But from what I can make of it, it doesn't seem groundless.
If he was in Tokyo prison, that means that he was put there by the Tokyo District Prosecutor.
In the end, they found him not guilty, is what I heard, she said. Still, he was in detention for a long time and had to endure a very intense investigation. They extended his incarceration a number of times and wouldn't grant bail.
But he won in court.
That's right. He was prosecuted but wasn't given a jail sentence. He apparently remained totally silent during the investigation.
My understanding is that the Tokyo District prosecutors are the cream of the crop, I said, a proud lot. Once they set their sights on someone, they have solid evidence before they arrest them and charge them. Their win rate in court is really high. So the investigation they did while he was in detention couldn't have been half-baked. Most people break down under that kind of scrutiny and sign whatever the prosecutors want them to. Ordinary people wouldn't be able to stay silent under that kind of pressure.
Still, that's what Mr. Manshiki did. He must have a strong will and a sharp mind.
Manshiki wasn't your average person, that was for sure. A strong will and a sharp mind were indeed part of his repertoire.
There's one thing I don't get, I said. Whether it is for tax evasion or money laundering or whatever, once the Tokyo District Prosecutor arrests you, it's reported on in the newspapers. And with an unusual name like Manshiki, I would remember the case. I used to be a pretty avid reader of newspapers.
I don't know about that. There's one other thing. I mentioned it before, but he bought that mountaintop mansion 3 years ago, almost forcing the owners to sell. Other people were living there then, and they had no intention at all of selling the house they'd just built. But Mr. Manshiki offered them money, or maybe pressured them in some other way, and drove them out. And then he moved in like some mean-spirited hermit crab.
Hermit crabs don't drive away what's living in a shell. They just quietly take over the leftover shell of a dead shellfish.
But there must be some hermit crabs that are mean.
I don't get it, I said, trying to avoid a debate over the ecology of hermit crabs.
If what you're saying is true, why would Mr. Manshiki insist so strongly that it had to be that house?
So much so that he drove the residents out and took over. That must have taken a lot of money and effort. And that mansion is really too gaudy, too conspicuous to suit him. It's a wonderful house for sure, but I just don't think it fits his tastes.
Plus, it's too big. He doesn't have a maid, lives alone, hardly ever has guests over. There's no need to live in such a huge place.
She drank the rest of the water.
There must be some special reason why it had to be that house, she went on. I have no idea why, though.
Anyway, he's invited me over to his place on Tuesday. Once I actually visit, I might learn more.
Make sure you check out the secret locked room, the one like Bluebeard's castle.
I'll remember to, I said.
For the time being, things have worked out well.
Meaning?
You finished the painting, Mr. Manshiki liked it, and you got a hefty payment for it.
I guess so, I said. I guess it did work out.
I'm relieved. Felicitations, maestro, she said. It was no lie to say that I felt relieved.
It was true that I'd finished the painting, and true that Manshiki had liked it, and also true that I was happy with the painting, and equally true that this resulted in a nice, healthy amount of money coming my way. For all that, though, I couldn't feel totally pleased with the way things had worked out. So much around me was still up in the air, left as is, with no clues to follow. The more I wanted to simplify my life, the more disjointed it seemed to become. As if searching for clues, I almost unconsciously reached out to hold my girlfriend. Her body felt soft and warm and damp with sweat. "I know exactly where you've been and what you've been up to," the man with the white Subaru Forester said. Chapter 20. The Moment When Existence and Non-Existence Coalesce. The next morning, I woke up at 5:30. It was Sunday morning. It was still pitch dark outside. After a simple breakfast in the kitchen, I changed into work clothes and went into the studio. As the eastern sky grew brighter, I switched off the light, threw open the window, and let chilly, fresh morning air into the room. I took out a fresh canvas and set it on the easel. The chirping of birds filtered in through the open window. The rain during the night had thoroughly soaked the trees. The rain had stopped just a while before, bright gaps in the clouds showing. I sat down on the stool and, sipping hot black coffee from a mug, stared at the empty canvas before me. I've always enjoyed this time, early in the morning, gazing intently at a pure white canvas. Canvas Zen is my term for it. Nothing is painted there yet, but it's more than a simple blank space. Hidden on that white canvas is what must eventually emerge. As I look more closely, I discover various possibilities which congeal into a perfect clue as to how to proceed. That's the moment I really enjoy. The moment when existence and non-existence coalesce. But on this day, I knew from the beginning what I would be painting. Emerging from this canvas would be a portrait of the middle-aged man with the white Subaru Forester. Up to this moment, the man had been patiently waiting inside me to be painted, and I had to paint his portrait not for anyone else, not by commission, not to earn a living, but for myself. Just as I had painted Manshiki's portrait, in order to make visible his reason for being, or at least the meaning it had for me, I had to paint him in my own way. I'm not sure why, but it had to be done. I closed my eyes and called to mind the figure of the man with the white Subaru Forester. I could distinctly recall the minutest details of his features. Early that second day, he'd looked straight at me from his seat in the restaurant. The morning paper on the tabletop was folded, white steam rising from his cup of coffee. The bright morning light shining in the large window. The restaurant filled with the clatter of cheap tableware. That whole scene came back in every detail. And in the midst of that scene, the man's face began to show some expression. "I know exactly where you've been and what you've been up to," his eyes told me. This time, I began with a rough draft. I stood up, grabbed a stick of charcoal, and stood before the canvas. On the blank space, I created the spot where the man's face would go. With no plan, without thinking, I drew in a single vertical line. A single line. The focal point from which everything else would emerge. What would emerge was the face of a thin, suntanned man, deep wrinkles on his forehead. Thin, piercing eyes. Eyes used to staring at the far-off horizon. Eyes dyed the color of the sky and sea. Hair cut short, dotted with white. My guess, a taciturn, long-suffering man. Around that central line, I used charcoal to add a few supplementary lines,
so the outlines of the man's face would appear. I stepped back to look at the lines I'd done, made a few corrections, and added some new lines. What was important was believing in myself, believing in the power of the lines, in the power of the space the lines divided. I wasn't speaking, but letting the lines and spaces speak. Once the lines and spaces began conversing, then color would finally start to speak, and the flat would gradually transform into the three-dimensional. What I had to do was encourage them all, lend them a hand, and more than anything, not get in their way. I kept working until 10:30. The sun had made a slow crawl to the midpoint in the sky. The gray clouds had broken into thin strands, driven away one after another beyond the mountains. No longer did water drip from the tips of the tree branches. I stepped back and examined the rough sketch I'd done from various angles. What I saw was the face of the man I'd remembered, or rather, the framework that should abide in that face. But there were a few too many lines. I needed to do some trimming. Subtraction was the order of the day, but that was for tomorrow. Best to end this day's work here. I put down the now shorter stick of charcoal and washed my smudged hands in the sink. As I dried my hands with a towel, my eyes came to rest on the bell on the shelf in front of me, and I picked it up. I shook it, and the sound was terribly light, dry, and outdated. I couldn't believe it was an enigmatic Buddhist implement that had been underground for ages. It sounded so different from what I'd heard in the middle of the night. No doubt the pitch black and stillness had added to the depth and clarity of the sound and made it carry farther. The question of who could possibly have been ringing that bell in the middle of the night remained an unsolved mystery. Though someone must have been down in the hole every night ringing it, sending out what had to be some kind of message, whoever it was had vanished. When we uncovered the hole, all that was there was this bell. The whole thing was baffling. I placed the bell back on the shelf. After lunch, I went outside and into the woods out back. I had on a thick gray hooded windbreaker and paint-stained sweatpants. I followed the damp path to the small shrine and walked around behind it. The thick board cover over the hole was piled with fallen leaves of different colors and shapes, leaves soaked by last night's rain. Since Manshiki and I had visited 2 days before, no one else seemed to have touched the cover. I wanted to make sure of that. I sat down on the damp stones and, listening to the calls of birds overhead, I gazed for a while at where the hole was. In the silence of the woods, it felt like I could hear the passage of time, of life passing by. One person leaves, another appears. A thought flits away and another takes its place. One image bids farewell, and another one appears on the scene. As the days piled up, I wore out, too, and was remade. Nothing stayed still, and time was lost. Behind me, time became dead grains of sand, which one after another gave way and vanished. I just sat there in front of the hole, listening to the sound of time dying. What would it feel like to sit at the bottom of that hole, all alone, I wondered, being shut away by oneself in a cramped, dark space. Manshiki had even given up his flashlight and the ladder. Without the ladder, without someone's help, specifically mine, it would be nearly impossible to escape from there. Why did he have to go to the trouble of putting himself into such a predicament? Did being down in that dark hole remind him of his solitary time behind bars in Tokyo prison? There was no way I could know that, of course. Manshiki lived his own life in his own way. I could say only one thing for sure. I would never be able to do that.
Nothing scared me more than dark, confined spaces. Put me in a place like that, and I wouldn't be able to breathe. I'd be so terrified. Even so, I was drawn to that hole. Drawn very strongly. So much so it felt like the hole was beckoning to me. I sat next to the hole for a good half hour. Then I stood up and walked home through the sunlight that filtered down through the trees. After 2 p.m., I had a call from Masahiko Amada. He had an errand to run near Odawara and wondered if he might drop by. Of course, I told him. I hadn't seen him in a while. He drove up just before 3. He brought a bottle of single malt whiskey as a present. I thanked him. Good timing, since I'd almost run out of whiskey. As always, he was stylishly dressed, neatly shaved, wearing glasses I had seen before, with shell-rimmed frames. He looked nearly the same as he had in the past, though admittedly his hairline was beating a slow-motion retreat. We sat in the living room and caught up. I told him how the landscapers had used heavy equipment to dig up the stone mound, how after that, a hole just under 6 feet in diameter had emerged, 9 feet deep, surrounded by a stone wall. A heavy lattice cover was over it, and when that was removed, all we found was an old Buddhist implement, like a bell. He listened intently as I told him the story, but he didn't say he wanted to see the hole or the bell. After that, I take it you didn't hear the bell at night? I don't hear it anymore, I said. That's great, he said, sounding a bit relieved. I can't handle those kind of spooky things. I try to avoid them at all costs. Let sleeping dogs lie? Exactly, Masahiko said. I leave that hole up to you. Do whatever you like. I told him how now, for the first time in what seemed like forever, I had the urge to paint. How, ever since I finished Menshiki's portrait 2 days ago, it was like some blockage had been removed. I felt like I was discovering a new original style, using portraits as a motif. I'd started the painting as a portrait, but what had eventually emerged was far from a conventional likeness. Even so, it was in essence still a portrait. Masahiko wanted to see Menshiki's portrait, but when I told him I'd already given it to him, he was disappointed. But the paint can't be dry yet, can it? He said he'd make sure it dries properly, I said. He seemed eager to have the painting as quickly as possible. I don't know, maybe he was worried I might change my mind and not give it to him. Masahiko said, impressed. Do you have any new work, then? I started on something this morning, I said. But it's still just a charcoal sketch, so even if you saw it, it wouldn't mean anything. That's okay. Would you mind showing it to me? I took him into the studio and showed him the sketch for The Man with the White Subaru Forester. It was just a rough sketch in charcoal, but Masahiko stood in front of the easel, arms folded, a hard look on his face. Interesting, he said a little later, squeezing the words out between his teeth. I was silent. It's hard to tell how it's going to develop, but it certainly does look like someone's portrait. Like the root of a portrait. A root buried deep in the ground. He was silent for a time. In a very deep, dark place, he went on. And this man, it is a man, right, is angry about something? What is he blaming? You got me. I haven't got that far. You haven't got that far, Masahiko repeated in a monotone. But there really is a deep anger and sadness here, and he can't spit it out. The anger is swirling around inside him. In college, Masahiko was in the oil painting department, though to be blunt about it, he wasn't known as a great painter. He was skilled enough, but his work lacked depth, something he himself admitted. He was, however, blessed with the skill of being able to instantly evaluate other people's paintings.
so whenever I felt stuck doing one of my own paintings, I'd ask his opinion. His advice was always accurate and impartial, as well as practical. And thankfully, he had no sense.